Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, and today I'm joined by Mr. Tiako Tsotse. Tiako, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, things, and how are you, Nick? Hi there, Herman. Hi to everyone watching.
I have a splitting headache, but let that never be a thing that stands in the way of freedom, liberty, and all that good stuff. So I do apologize if I lose my train of thought or anything while I'm yammering on. And of course, we're also joined today by Mr. Herman Pretorius, who I believe is also feeling a little bit under the weather.
Yes, slightly. I've got a scratchy throat, but that's fine. But on a sort of slightly related topic, Nick, I'm always, when you begin with introductions, there's always this moment of high tension, who you're going to go with first. And I always try to figure out what your methodology is, and you've got no predictability, none whatsoever. Seniority, I've tried, nothing. Alphabet, nothing. Handsome, nothing. It's just, I can't figure out your methodology, but I'll worry about that in on the inside.
There is no methodology, Herman. It's all, I like to keep you all on your toes. All right, but unfortunately, we have to start today on a bit of a sad note. And this is about a great South African and a guy who was a friend of the Institute of Race Relations. At least he did quite a lot of stuff occasionally with us. He attended events and things. And he was a great guy. And this is, of course, we're talking about economist Mike Schussler, who unfortunately has just passed away after a short battle with cancer. Herman? I interacted with him a little bit. He seemed like a really great guy. I always enjoyed his analysis and his writing. You had some thoughts also on his life and career?
Yes. So I can't claim that I knew Mike well, that he knew me well, but I knew his work well. And we did work together for some IRR research and some IRR campaigns. And he was one of those very, very rare individuals who have the ability to understand complex things, analyze complex things, and then explain complex things in a way that the layman could understand. For an economist, that was a rare gift, and the passion and the care that he felt for his job and for the people he worked with was really, it was tangible. And his concern, his willingness to participate in some public pressure campaigns that I ran for the IRR, really made it ingrained a deep respect and appreciation for the man. And perhaps I could read fans' tribute to him. Mike Schussler was a giant. He understood the challenges faced by our country and cared deeply for all who struggled under bad economic policy. The clarity of his thinking, the depth of his analysis, and the honesty with which he engaged with difficult and fundamental issues gave South Africans a formidable champion for freedom, free markets, and prosperity. Mike's passing is an enormous loss to our country. He was a great South African. Our condolences and our prayers go out to his loved ones. We will carry out forward Mike's advocacy for ideas and policies that lift up our country and its people.
Tiako, do you have anything to add before we move on to the show?
Well, I don't have much to add, apart from just saying that he was a people's economist and he has always found a way of bringing economics to the people in a way that they could relate to it, almost like Thomas Sowell in the USA. So really, it's a great loss to South Africans.
Indeed, it's been a bad year for sort of freedom-loving economists this year, as of course we also earlier lost our colleague Ian Cruikshanks. So not a great year for freedom-aligned economists, but hopefully we can carry forward the work that these guys did in understanding the problems that the devil.
There was something very special about Ian, if I might quickly say, and I never forget it, and that's the sort of spirit that you can have these colleagues stay with you. Ian was a small man. He was a racing driver and many, many things. But him and Mike had this termination of all their analysis at the point of, what does it mean for us? It was never enough to keep it in the abstract. They always brought it down to what does it mean for us? And as long as we can learn from that and perpetuate that sort of thinking, I do think that their difference that they made in life can continue on beyond.
Definitely. Anyway, let's get into the news of today. And this is a story that I think came out last week, but it's sort of been percolating through the commentariat and the social media bubbles and all of that. And this is a discussion about the future of the Afrikaans Language Monument, also known as the Taal Monument, in Paarl. That's actually a great, it was the best town in the country to put the Taal Monument in. But anyway, Western Cape Cultural Affairs MEC, Anru Marais, said last week that she is dismayed by a proposal to remove the Afrikaans language from the Taal Monument in Paarl. So the idea here is apparently Arts and Culture Minister Natie Ntetwa believes that the Taal Monument focuses too much on Afrikaans and that the name should be changed to be more inclusive of all of South Africa's indigenous languages, not just Afrikaans. And the monument should basically be for all South Africans, not just Afrikaners. That was the reasoning, I think, that was suggested by the department. Now, I don't think the department has entirely confirmed this, but these plans have been regarded as credible by at least the Western Cape government. And the MEC said in response to some of this, it is time we start examining how we are spending public funds in the name of social cohesion if actions that are being taken will lead to further divides in the country. Public funds for arts and culture should be properly spent on supporting our artists in the development of our indigenous languages rather than hollow grand gestures. Marais went on to say that the Taal Monument symbolizes the diversity and growth of the Afrikaans language, is an important part of our country's history, and its name is directly connected to its origin and meaning. To change that name would take away from the historical value of the Afrikaans language. We must ensure that we do not lose sight of the importance of protecting all our indigenous languages in our aim to give equal access and representation to all. So I guess some of the questions that are raised by this are, you know, South Africa, it's a diverse place. It's got a lot of different cultural groups, and these languages and cultural groups are really enshrined in our constitution, right? We have 11 official languages, which I think the most of any in the world. The question is, what does it mean to live in this society? How should language be represented? How should we remember the past? Should there be one monument for everyone? Should each language have its own monument? And I think the deeper question, and I want both of your thoughts on this, you know, what are the politics behind this? Why is the ANC perhaps looking at doing this now? So, Tiego, let me start with you. What do you make of this? How do you think language should be celebrated in South Africa?
Well, I think language should be celebrated in different ways and without anything stopping anyone from celebrating their language, right? That's the first point. But the second point is around the second question you asked, the political question and the politics of the whole thing. You know, at first when I read the article around the matter, I was angry at first, filled with many questions. Why would the government want to spend so much money on renaming this? But even the fundamental question of why do they feel the need that this even needs to be renamed? I mean, this is a monument built to celebrate the African culture, built to celebrate the African language in 1975, right? But at some point, I think afterwards, I began to understand. I became quite understanding, and I think all of us really should become understanding of where Natie Ntetwa and cohorts come from, right? I think they come from politics of not knowing how to build anything. Politics of just renaming, politics of just collapsing things. Since they've come into government, most of what they've done as a Department of Arts and Culture was to rename stuff, collapse stuff that had already been in existence, or simply failed to maintain stuff that were already in existence that were assisting artists and people in the arts and culture landscape. But I think we should look at it in that way. This is a government that's failing to build onto what had already been built, what was already working for us. So now that they realize that they're failing, they'd rather just go back and rename anything. But there's no progress in that. There's progress in developing more stuff, coming up with names for those new stuff. But even in coming up with names for those new stuff, truly, including everyone, including all cultures, including all languages, celebrating them equally without discriminating against the other. What's happening here now is that the minister and his department really want to discriminate against the Afrikaans language. There's really a message that they're sending out that we have too much of Afrikaans or something of that nature, but it's not possible. If you feel that any other culture or language is underrepresented, build on. Don't go and collapse what already is there that's working.
So to me, you know, I think you're exactly right about the politics of sort of collapsing on and renaming rather than building. It really feels to me that whenever the ANC is in, feels like it's not in a great place. It likes to go into the realm of symbols where it can fight on a sort of almost emotional ground. And I'm sure that in a move like this, that the objective is to get someone like Steve Hofmeyr to go and chain himself to the language monument. And then there can be a big standoff where people are, you know, racially abusing each other. And then this drama can be used to divide the country and make sure that people remember, you know, what the ANC sort of why it's in power and what it was fighting against. That's, I think, their ideas. They hope to keep their political fortunes alive with this. Herman, your thoughts on this? Am I being too cynical in my analysis of why this renaming decision may be taken?
Not at all. Not at all. It is. The ANC has run out of other things to do. They have no new ideas. They have no new solutions. So they do whatever they do when their back's against the wall, and that is try to divide and rule, try to resurrect the issues on which they feel they can win the battle of ideas because the balance of forces are in their favor. And it's an old Marxist thing. It really, really is entrenched in the ideology and in the methodology of the socialist battle of ideas and the National Democratic Revolution. This sort of division is part and parcel of these types of movements, especially when they run out of steam. And it sort of reminds me of that meme where you know, this man's having a heart attack. Is there a doctor? Is someone a doctor here? And then someone says, yes, I'm a doctor. And then it's in this sense, it's essentially South Africa is the patient having a heart attack, and the electorate is going, you know, is there a doctor nearby? And the ANC goes, yes, well, I'm a doctor. And they say, well, can you try to fix him? He says, well, no, I'm a doctor of racial division. I can't do anything about his actual health, but perhaps I can scold him on the racism entrenched in his DNA. So it's incredibly, incredibly frustrating, but it's also incredibly politically transparent. Ngathi Mthethwa, I mean, speaking about hollow symbols, Ngathi Mthethwa has had a barnstormer of a few weeks here. He's gone from, you know, one pole to pole. The problem here is that he can only engage in symbols that are ill-advised, unproductive, deconstructive, subtractive, and divisive. So, I mean, it's really par for the course if we look at the lifeline of the ANC. But there's something more sinister here, and that is a deliberate and a committed ignorance of history. Afrikaans is the most racially and ethnically diverse language on the continent of Africa. The majority of its speakers are not white. The Taal Monument's own architecture pays homage to the fact that it is this bridging cultural, ethnic phenomenon between your Germanic, Franco, Indo-Latinic languages brought to South Africa by settlers, the Malay influence, the local influence of the Khoisan, and all the iterations of language that has, you know, happened over the last few centuries with Afrikaans. It is not a white language. Ironically, this is the same mistake that the apartheid government made, thinking that they own the language. Well, Ngathi Mthethwa here thinks he can disown the language. The language is ethnically diverse, racially diverse, inclusive, with a minority of white speakers. And more to the point, if indigenous languages were something that the ANC cared about. They've had 3 decades to do something about it. And I know people who work in language development and language technology. The sparseness of state funding in terms of research for developing African languages or other African languages as academically viable languages is either non-existent or insufficient. A few years ago, it was such a joyful moment when someone at KZN became the first a doctoral student, I think, of engineering to submit their doctoral thesis in Zulu and getting their PhD. And that was a remarkable moment that has never been followed up with any meaningful government policy. Afrikaans ranks among the 3 so-called miracle languages of the 20th century, alongside modern Hebrew and Bahasa, that went within a century from either Creole, a language or a form of a dialect, to a fully fledged academic, art, cultural and scientific language. And there was much to learn. And there's if I remember correctly, it was a Dr. Tefu at UNISA who once said, rather than alienating and antagonizing Afrikaans and toxifying and corroding it, the government should learn from the blueprint of Afrikaans, that within a century, it achieved this level of a spiritual language with a biblical translation fully incorporated, mathematical, technological, scientific, biological, all the components that make a language a viable vehicle for communication in the 21st century. All of those things Afrikaans did well. And rather than just antagonizing and dividing, there was a model there for the government to follow. And I mean, it's to be disappointed that the ANC missed an opportunity for reconciliation and constructive growth. I mean, it would be naive to be disappointed by that. But this is just so shallow. It is immensely shallow. It misses the value of Afrikaans' journey. It misses the cultural, linguistic, ethnic, and historical origins and diversity of Afrikaans is the most diverse language on the African continent, and it by happenstance, the 3rd biggest language in the country. So it's just pathetic. When you leave reason out of this, you are left with a politics. So no, Nick, you are not cynical to go that way. It's the only way to go.
Well said. I'm afraid we've gone a bit long on this one, so I'm going to go to our next topic here. And this is a story that I think is one of those ones that's not a huge deal in of itself, but is quite symptomatic of some of the problems that we face as a country. And this is, there's recently an arrest by the Hawks of, there's a little bit of feedback there from Tiago's side. There were some arrests by the Hawks recently of 5 suspects in connection with falsifying South African passports and identity documents. So apparently these 5 individuals are running a scam where they would pay South Africans for their details, which were used on the passports, including their fingerprints. The passports were allegedly made at Home Affairs after hours. And basically what would happen is once they had created the fake documents, they bring the foreign nationals who had asked to buy these illegal documents from them to get their photos taken, and then that would be put on the document. So there would basically be 2 people sharing all the ID documents, with the exception that there was a different photo for each, I think. And I think this speaks to a larger problem. So apparently this was pretty cheap. They were paying South African citizens about 500 rand to use their details on these things. So it was consensual. It wasn't stolen identities. And a couple of thousand to produce the final document. And, of course, we're seeing a lot of debate in this country about immigration, the role of how many foreigners should be in the country, whether foreigners are hurting employment prospects, stuff like that. And when you see corruption like this, it's really, I think, hurtful to the entire debate, because I think some of the cooler heads on the immigration restrictionist side say, look, it's fine if legal immigrants are here and they're under our laws and they're complying with everything. We have no problem with that. Our only problem is with illegal immigrants. Well, the problem with corruption like this is that suddenly it gives everyone a room to say, but who's really a legal immigrant? Do we really know? Because just because you have documents doesn't mean that you're a legal immigrant. Herman, your thoughts on this story.
Yeah, the point you're making, it sort of reminds of the BEE thing. If you're going to muddy the waters, then you undermine the people who have to swim in them. I don't know if I've shared this anecdote before on the story, but I once spoke to a collection of gogos at a clinic, and the one said to me, and the others nodded in firm agreement, that they would quite often, if there's a white student doctor and a few black student doctors there, they would, this lady said she would rather wait a few extra hours to see the white doctor who she knew was there on merit, rather than see some of the black doctors who might not be. And she made a point of saying, this isn't saying that the black doctors are bad or are incompetent, but she doesn't want to take that risk with her health. And it's that similar sort of corrosion where if the qualifications and the bars that need to be clear, that are rational and meritorious, if those start being, you know, broken down by the government in charge, then your point of reference for reasonable and justifiable and just action really becomes difficult to discern. So you are sort of painting, tarring immigrants with a single brush, and a quite a dangerous and a destructive brush at that. But this is also another indication that cater deployment isn't a victimless crime, in the sense that these things, it's toxic how they take away the integrity of institutions, and the fact that these people were clearly not suited to the role of public service, that they engaged in these sort of corrupt activities, one has to go back and ask whether these people deserve to be in those roles in the first place, and how did they get them? And I'm willing to put a lot on the table. I'm not unlike the Dalai Lama, I'm not a Tibetan man, but if I were, I would be willing to go to a great extent to say that if we had a civil service focused on meritorious appointment and actually service, public service delivery, this sort of nonsense would perhaps not be eliminated, but would be cut down significantly. This is the rot setting in, and it will have consequences on human beings with some real pain and some real suffering, because it does fundamentally undermine the belief that people can have in you know the social contract of the community they are part of.
Teko, what do you make of this story? I think I pretty much agree with everything Herman is saying there. It really seems to me like this is an issue that's only going to heat up because of all of the rising tide of xenophobia and concern about illegal immigration into the country. What do you make of the story?
Well, firstly, I agree with everything Herman has said, of course. And, you know, after reading the article, I found myself asking myself many questions around crime, for example. What would then happen if one of these people given the IDs, or one of these people given a South African ID, commits a crime? Who do we then run after if the fingerprints on that ID is not the right person's fingerprints? So such questions came up, and really the conclusion I arrived at is that we really, 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 really need to do something about our government come 2024. We need a better government, a government that's going to, like Herman has mentioned, come up with systems, a merit system when hiring people, come up with better monitoring systems and stuff of that nature. But more than anything, I am concerned about the issue of crime, number one. But also, I wonder what these people are going to get. Well, these people now having been given IDs are then going to use the IDs for, since the ID numbers and the fingerprints are not theirs. Why do they need the IDs then if it's not their details there? They can't officially use the IDs. What are the IDs for? Unless they are, of course, for showing to just police when they do come across them on the streets. But more than anything, regarding the 500, I don't think it was actually that cheap to make the IDs. The 500s are what were given to South African citizens who were willing to form part of the whole thing. But I am quite sure that the administrators behind this made a whole lot of money out of the whole thing. They just gave those other citizens 500. But yeah, it does put, it puts our lives at danger, South Africans, when stuff like this happen. Because next time someone comes and robs in your house, police come take fingerprints and they find that it's a Tandega who came into your house, but it's actually a Chirateto who came to your house, then it's a crisis.
Indeed. And yeah, no, as has been mentioned in the comments, and also I think what you guys are alluding to here is that the civil service needs some very urgent reforms, because they were making these documents in the Home Affairs building after hours.
You know, if I may just jump in, on Friday night, on my way to my brother's place from my house, I drove past the Department of Traffic, and there were two Golf, VW Golfs parked in there. Jokingly, I said to my brother that it was at night at around 6 p.m. I said to my brother, the department was already shut. I said to my brother jokingly that these are probably stolen cars that have been registered at night. So when I saw this article come out, I just laughed and thought that, yeah, it's really happening in South Africa. Everything is possible in this land.
That's a good point. Every time someone has a polo, it always gets stolen, man. Anyway, that's a very good observation. Okay, right, let's move on to our last story here for today. I think we're going to skip the wanton speculation about the deputy president, and instead, Herman, we had you just before the Australian election. Could you very briefly give us an update of what ended up happening after the votes were cast in Australia, a country where it is compulsory to vote?
Yes.
One wonders how South Africa's political system would change if it was compulsory to vote as well.
Yes. No, I had exactly this conversation the other day with my wife. And the interesting thing is that were it compulsory in South Africa to vote, number one is it will be unenforceable because millions of people will then have to pay the fine. Millions of people won't be able to afford the fine, so millions of people will have to go to jail. So it's an interesting question, and so I see both sides of the argument, but it does sit uncomfortable with me. But the long and short of the Australian election is that the Liberal Party and the National Party in the permanent coalition have now been kicked out of government, and the Labour Party, led by Anthony Albanese, has taken control. It's not quite clear yet, well, I'm not convinced yet, whether there will be an absolute majority for the Labour Party. Last time I looked at the count, they were on 74 seats, and you need 76 seats to form a majority in the chamber, has 151 seats. But what was very interesting is that if you look a year ago, Scott Morrison was riding high in the polling. He was popular. He was the preferred prime minister of, you know, north of 60% of Australians. And then he got kicked out of office. And there are a few reasons for that. But I think fundamentally, as I mentioned last time, it is the first great scalp of the cost of living crisis bringing governments down. The cost of living crisis. I mean, Australia has an unemployment rate of 3.9%. They are back to economic growth. They have a massive deficit, but a comparatively manageable deficit due to the Liberal governments managing during the lockdown, you know, fad. But all in all, the government can't claim that, or that no one can claim that the government was a complete disaster. And yet the cost of living crisis wiped out entirely Scott Morrison's reputation for competence and the Liberal Party's popularity. An interesting political offshoot of this is that there was what the Australians on are calling a teal revolution, where teal is traditionally the color of independence in Australia, on the crossbench, they call it. So you've got the red of the Labour Party, and then you've got the blue of the coalition. And the teal candidates essentially scalped a whole generation of moderate conservative Liberal Party members, people like Josh Frydenberg, who was the treasurer, the minister of finance, and the likely heir apparent to Scott Morrison, but he lost his seat. And the Liberal Party is now in an interesting position where the moderate urban areas of Australia that moderated the overall conservatism of the party now turned against the party, so got rid of the moderate influences within the party, to the benefit of independent Teal candidates. So the Liberal Party is now really at risk of drifting a bit further right than the population of Australia is. And I think one might even see that in the essentially unchallenged ascension of Peter Dutton to the anticipated role of leader of the Liberal Party. So it's a dangerous thing, the cost of living crisis. You can go from high to low, and there's sometimes very, very little government can do about it. But look for this pattern to repeat. It sort of started showing in France, and it really has now claimed it for its first scalp in Australia.
I think that's a really good point. And yeah, inflation is going to claim many scalps, I think. Anyway, unfortunately, Tiakua, I can't get to you now because we are out of time. But thank you very much, everyone, for listening. We hope that you found the show interesting. And we will, of course, be back tomorrow on The Daily French Show. I hope you all have a wonderful day. And cheers.